just in case. Yep. I'll grab it if I need it. Okay. I feel like I ought to be singing the Star-Spangled Banner. Great to see everybody. Congratulations on the years. And to my sweetheart, Liz. Yeah, she keeps me from being the oldest rat in the barn a lot. And so I hope she keeps on doing it, too. And if I could speak as fast as Karen, I'd be a little less concerned than God. I'm going to go as fast as I can. It won't sound like it, because I'm from North Carolina. We not only talk slow, we think slow. So we'll lace into it the best you can. Tommy told me that Fremont was his son. And I looked at him, and he got exactly the same hairdo. It had to be right on. Well, it has been a great deal, and I think this is the latest I've ever gone on a wind-up Saturday night meeting. I'm gonna go ahead and get out of this coat. You've all seen it. You got it. Okay, that's it. Hey, it takes a lot of work to win the Masters. But I am delighted to be here. I've been to a few state conventions in Florida, and this one is certainly one of the liveliest and most thoroughly put together conferences I've been to here or anywhere else. And so good work, really good work. Yeah. Now I'm gonna do what we do. We don't preach or teach. What we do is share our experience, and that's what I want to do, is share my experience in this program, and maybe give a little encouragement to the two with just a couple of days of sobriety. I'm a guy. I found myself. I mean, I knew where I was, but I attended the first AA meeting that I ever attended on the 2nd of February. Nice Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock in the afternoon is when the meeting was, and I walked into AA that day, and I don't think I've ever felt more out of place anywhere than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I was the only one that ever knew me who didn't think I was, but I didn't. I really thought I was a budding genius who was going to get it together one day, but I managed to stay drunk all the way to getting genius. And so I was a guy that I really didn't. I listened to the people, everybody there. In fact, everybody everywhere I went for a long time were older than me. Most of them quite a few years older than me. Yeah, now it's the shoes on the other foot. Yeah, now I'm usually the oldest rat in the barn. So if you stay here long enough, that stuff happens. But when I walked in, I didn't identify with people. Everybody in there, when they talked about their experiences, most of them had drunk more years than I was years old. And now everything's not true that you hear in AA. It just borders on true. But it was one guy said that he stayed solid drunk for 40 years. Now, that's crazy. I mean, nobody could do that. You know? So I listened with some skepticism. And so I didn't really, really, really feel like I fit in. Now, I was fortunate, extremely fortunate, in that I went into an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go into a little drop-in chat room type of place. It was a good, solid, three-legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it happened to be in a penitentiary, but it doesn't make any difference where it is. It does matter to me where it is, but it really doesn't matter where it is. What it is what counts. And I've never been in a stronger, more effective AA group than the first one I went into, thank God. And I've never looked back from the day I walked in. And so I'm deeply grateful for that. Now, I'm a guy who I'm going to tell you in a rushing hurry, whether it sounds like it or not. Yeah, I'm a guy that I had a history that should have told me I was alcoholic. I'd been in trouble a lot of times, never legally so much, you know, unless you call getting locked up for drunk. Yeah, I think that's just overuse of authority to be locking up somebody for being drunk. But I'd done that many, many times. And I was a guy that I think everybody who ever met me that had any observation of how I handled myself concluded I was alcoholic pretty quick. I had one guy tell me that I was the best employee he ever had, 3 days a week, and the rest of the time I'm missing in action. And so I heard it over and over and over. I was booted out of the military when I was 20 years old. I started out to become an officer. I was picked out as somebody with a lot of potential. I've been told I had a lot of potential all of my life, most of it never realized. And they tried to make an officer out of me. I didn't do well at that. I tended to get drunk an awful lot. And they didn't, I guess they had enough drunk officers. They didn't need another one. And so they sent me up to the Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. And that is really a wonderful place to reward a guy for having a lot of potential. I worked on a rock, never did know what for. I just stood there. And anyway, it was a lousy place to be. And an awful lot of people went nuts who were there. We had a shipload of people one time got shipped back to the States because they just went bananas. I mean, they were health freaks. They'd get out and run up and down rocks and all that. And most of them just sort of snapped and went down. Drunks were laying up there fat and happy. Didn't know if we were in Alaska or Aleutians or Hawaii. Didn't matter too much. And that's where I developed alcoholism. It didn't happen there. It happened way back. It goes way back, as you well know, that the etiology of alcoholism goes a lot further back than the first drink. And so I was a guy who was set up well for it. And in Alaska, in the Aleutians, they serve beer to just keep you from going bonkers. And I took them up on it handily. And that's where I developed alcoholism. Now, I was a bad drunk before, but I developed alcoholism. There are a lot of technical definitions for that. Best one I've ever heard or seen is in the third chapter, more about alcoholism, about halfway down the page. That's about as close as I can come to naming a page. More about alcoholism halfway down. And it's got the best definition I've ever heard of alcoholism. It says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. And that absolutely describes what happened. I didn't know it then. But when I was 18 years old out on that rock, I crossed that line. And I certainly didn't know it until I looked at it in hindsight. But I was a guy who, once I crossed that line, I could not predict what I would do if I took a drink. And I set up a lifelong pattern of just waking up in bizarre places. I mean, really places I didn't have no business being. While I was on that rock, I'm an animal lover. I mean, I love pigs even. Not that far. So if they're butchered, I like them. But I'm an animal lover. I was out there, and I don't know whose place it was, but somebody had a hut there on that rock. I woke up in a bed in there, and I thought it was a cocker spaniel in bed with me. Now, I don't mind cockers, but it was on my pillow. And so I'm trying to push him out of the bed, and then it finally dawned on me it wasn't no cocker spaniel there. What had happened, I had done what many alcoholics die of. I had gone to sleep with a cigarette in my hand, apparently. And what was on there that looked like a cocker spaniel was the burn pattern of the fire going around my body. I came out, it was nothing but a big blister on my shoulder. But I mean, I was pretty well on the way then as an 18-year-old young guy. And simply, if I took a drink, I couldn't predict what I would do. They messed with me as long as they were willing to do so, and then they just gradually got more and more fed up with me, sent me back to the States, to Kansas, I guess, for punishment. But anyway, I went there and wound up. One day, back then there was no such thing as treatment for alcoholism. It didn't exist. Except they had a few little places they could hide folks, but there was no treatment for alcoholism. The military didn't have any tools to deal with alcoholism. Didn't know what to do. And so I had a lot of nice people who would try to give me encouragement and say, "Man, you need to quit this stuff and all that stuff." But there was no real program for dealing with that. And so one morning in December of 51, I believe, I came to on the floor of the Junction City, Kansas jail, and on my usual posture on the floor, and uncomfortably close to the bathroom. And I think too close, because I was more than a little gamey when I woke up. And now I really look beautiful, you know, after something like that. And four crisply dressed young MPs, military police guys, came in to take me out. And so they took me out, and I'm looking like a scarecrow, and they take me out. And I go into the base, and they put me up in front of four officers, and they really didn't know what to do. They were good people, but they had no tools. They had simply no idea what to do with people like me. And so they were considerate, but they were decided on what they were going to do, and it was fine with me. And they said, you know, you've always been described as a guy with a lot of potential, but unfortunately you've never used it. And so what we found is that we just can't go any further with you. You don't respond to what people have tried to do with you, and we're going to have to let you go. Now, I'm 20 years old. He handed me a piece of paper, and he had the same paper. He read it, and it said, undesirable discharge, unfit for military service, -alcoholism. Well, that didn't mean anything to me. I mean, he might have told me I had a broken ankle. It didn't mean that. It didn't mean that much. What it did mean is I was free at last, and I'm going to get out of there. Man, I'll go out of there and take my place in this world, and I sure did. And it wasn't much of a place. And I hit the ground and did fairly well. I got with a company and drunk. I mean, it's amazing how people evaluate folks. I was drunk most of the time selling a product that was hard to sell, and was voted salesman of the year for that company in Charlotte. And I thought, man, these people like somebody that drinks it. And so, so I did. So I had the capability, but just would just screw up everything I got anywhere close to. And so it just same old pattern set up. You know, was going to jail and all this kind of stuff. And for some reason one day, a few of us characters got together, and we decided to do something venturesome and go up to Detroit. I think we'd heard that everybody up there made automobiles and were very wealthy people, and we were going to go up there and party time. And so we did, and I went. And I worked for General Motors for a while. They didn't know I was working, but I was working. And I was missing a lot. But they eventually fired me. I was one of the people who made the 1953 Buick. And I know there's some folks as old as me in Florida. And if you bought a 53 Buick, I'll talk with you about a ninth step. I'm sorry about that. But I didn't mean to do it. It was just one of those things. And so I got fired from General Motors, blackballed around the world, couldn't have got a job sweeping the floor. And then I just started a pattern of... I was always somebody that wanted to work, but just didn't do it very well. And so I just set up a pattern of just going from one thing to another and getting fired and dismissed. Sometimes just forget where I worked. And just that kind of meaningless, mindless kind of behavior. And I had a job one time, got fired from pulling rusty nails out of scrap lumber. I mean, my God, how do you get fired from that? I mean, you know where else to go. And... they sacrificed me, though, and let me go. And I wound up, I was living up in Flint, Michigan. It's been twice voted the worst city in the United States in which to live. I helped put it on the chart, I think, because I was there and I was not a model citizen. And I'm not a criminal. I never have been. I've never overtly committed a crime in my life of any magnitude, except just drunk, sleeping on the street, sleeping in somebody else's house. I mean, just stuff like that. But I've never deliberately committed a crime. But when you're living in a city like Flint, Michigan, and you're scrambling around the streets like I was doing, you're going to do what you have to do. And the economy there is a little different than it is for the average world. You know, I sold my blood $5 a throw, and I'd let them pump me dry if they hadn't had controls on that kind of thing. And there was an economy there. It was essentially he who is friskiest drinks first. And so each night there, you were either the rollee or the roller, because somebody going to get rolled every night, and whoever was friskiest could drink, and the other was going to snooze on. And so I wound up doing that. And that was the economy. That was not crime. You know, it'd get me one night, I'll get you the next night. Nobody ever called the police because they'd arrest everybody. I mean, they, nobody goes. So anyway, that's where I wound up. Sold my blood, $5 a throw. And I would have let them pump me dry had they not had controls on that sort of thing. But they did. And so I wound up like it. Now, I was obviously a guy who was going to wind up with no happy ending. It's pretty obvious that that would be so. And I really didn't have too much concern about it. I was just crashing through life and doing whatever I had to do to survive. And one morning, many of you know, I got a ton of friends in this room. Many of you know, I was one of those who did what most alcoholics in this room, or families maybe even more, have feared doing. And that's doing great harm to somebody else. And I was not somebody that was deliberately trying to impose something on people. But I woke up one morning in jail in Flint, and that was a no novelty. That was a routine thing. And after I was awake for a little while, I knew the procedures there because I was a regular. And about 10 o'clock, the jailer would come by, see if anybody wanted to try to get out. And we knew each other quite well. And so he walked by, and I said, "Hey, guy, when can I get out?" And he just looked at me with a look of utter scorn and said, "I hope never." had no idea what he's talking about, but I knew he was not playing. A lot of times he was playing, but he wasn't playing, and that was obvious. And he kept walking, and I didn't give it any heavy thought. I just walked back into the tank, and one of the guys in there, didn't know him, but a guy, he just pulled my sleeve, and he said, "Man, do you know what you're in here for?" And I said, "No, do you?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Last night, some guy was driving drunk down the main street of the city and struck and killed two people in an automobile accident, and they've arrested you for the crime." And I had no earthly idea I understood what he was saying, but I had absolutely no connection to anything he was talking about, and I thought, my God, that couldn't be. And nobody ever formally told me that, but it was pretty obvious that there was something going on big time. And so I was so devastated with just the thought of having done something like that. The possibility of it. I didn't believe it, but just the possibility was devastating to me. I was not that kind of person. And so I felt so, even before I knew it had happened, I was so full of guilt and shame and remorse. I was ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes. Never mind, you know, trying to get out or anything like that. And I'll never know who or why, but one of the policemen there that I never knew because I never tried to find out. I think he did it personally and privately. But it was easy to find. My record told exactly my whole history. So this fellow called my family. My mother and sister were all they were. And called and said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble, and he's talking himself into more. So if you want to do something for him, you better come on up." And my family did what families of alcoholics do. It doesn't have to make sense. Families of alcoholics, I honestly believe that families of alcoholics are punished more than alcoholics because they have to deal with it sober. They have to deal with the embarrassment, the shame, humiliation, and fear. And my family was no different. Doesn't make any sense. They were working in a mill over in Gaston County, North Carolina. And they made a trip to Michigan that they couldn't afford to make. But that's what families do. And they came up to get a guy out of jail that didn't want out of jail. But I didn't know how to say that to anybody. And so when they came up, and I was just ashamed and humiliated that they were there. And then they did what families do again. They got an attorney that they couldn't afford. And I didn't want out of jail, but I didn't know how to tell anybody that. What I wanted to do was disappear. And they got an attorney, and he did what attorneys do. He got negotiated my release on bond. When I walked out, it had nothing to do with alcoholism. I'd been told I was alcoholic by numbers of people, but it never meant a single thing to me. And so when I walked out of that jail, I knew I would never take another drink. And it had nothing to do with an inability to drink. It had to do with overwhelming guilt. You know, how could you possibly take a drink after having done something as horrible as that? And but the answer is obvious. You know, when you understand alcoholism from the inside, the answer is obvious. And so I got out, didn't know what to do with myself, walked the streets all day, all night, didn't drink all night till about noon the next day, and then I started to drink, of course. And from late May of 1956, until the 19th of November, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. And that's not some casual remark. That's a fact. I've worked with thousands of alcoholics. Just like Liz, I came in when 12-step calls were the order of the day. I held an alcoholic in my arms while he died before we ever had such a thing as treatment. If you took him to a hospital, it'd put they'd lock up both of you. And so this stuff just didn't exist. And I held this guy while he died. And even as he died, he wasn't like me. He was still protesting he wasn't like us and died. But even he wasn't an alcoholic like me. When I started to drink in late May, I literally drank like nobody I've ever seen. I have no question that I was absolutely trying to drink myself to death. I have no question about that. I think the only reason I didn't overtly commit suicide was I didn't want to leave a family with more guilt and shame than they already felt. And maybe if they found me just dead in an alley or laying in a street or frozen or whatever, there would at least be a question. But if I just overtly committed suicide, it would be something that they would carry. So at least I had that much decency left in there somewhere. And I was at the end of the line. I knew it. And so I just stayed drunk. And then I was waiting trial. I went to trial on the 19th of November. And the 19th of November, about 9 o'clock in the morning, I finished a bottle of gin, had probably about that much, about 3 or 4 inches of gin. And I finished that to go to court. And thank God, it's been my last drink. And so I didn't know at the time, wasn't thinking of things like that. But I just drank it because it was there and I was there. And then went to the court. There was no trial in the usual sense of the word. I mean, there was no give and take. I mean, I had to put me on the stand and all I can say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't know. That's the hell of blackouts. You know, somebody can tell you did anything and the best you can say is, I don't know, man, I wouldn't do that. And so I sat there and listened. I listened to it just like the jury did. I listened to the policeman who investigated crime, said he was going there at the crime scene, and he saw this guy kind of staggering down the street that he identified as me. And he said, I walked up to him and said, was there an accident here? And he said, there sure was. And I said, I think I might have been involved in it. And I heard that in the testimony. And then so he took me on to jail, and that's when I woke up and was greeted with the fact of what it appeared that I had done. And so I listened to that trial, and it was obvious that I was guilty. Had no quarrel with it whatsoever, nor any protest. And the lawyer did a good job, like lawyers will do. And when he got through, they did the sentencing, and I was found guilty and sentenced to a term of 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I'd been in countless jails and stockades in the military and pea farms, stuff like that, but I'd never been in them. I'd never even seen a prison to know what I was looking at. But I knew just from the people that I hustled with on the street that it was not going to be Disneyland, because if they had those characters I hung out with, it couldn't be Disneyland. And so I went in with... took me down 60 miles or so to the prison, and then on a chain with 5 other guys, just like cattle going in. And we walked through a gate in the wall and in. And when I walked through that gate, I had 2 thoughts on my mind. One was that I'll never come out of here alive. I had absolutely no question of that, nor any major concern. If I ever do, it'll be toes down, not up. And so I really didn't have any real trauma about that. I just knew that fatalistic, that was it. And the other thought I had was, well, buddy, you won't hurt anybody else. That was the other one. So I walked in. And I intended to serve my entire sentence not thinking, doing whatever it took to not think. And it was a single cell type of place. You put me in there, I counted cockroaches, cracks in the wall, you name it. If there's anything to keep my mind moving some direction. And if it had been necessary, without any question, had it been necessary for me to ask for help, I never would have done it. I would have never done it. I was so full of guilt and shame, I wouldn't ask anybody for a drink of water, for God's sakes. Never mind help. And so what I meant to do was just spend my time not thinking. And I've got my cell, 39 third 8 block, missed cell number 39 on the third tier of cell block number 8. And doesn't mean a lot to anybody except me. That's an address I don't want to reoccupy. I know that. And that's what I intended to do, was just sit there and not think. And amazing thing. The guy that sort of booked me in, you know, like they always do, a register and a social history and all that, guy did that, and he went through it, and he pulled out my record. I'd never seen, you know, my cumulative record of stuff that they'd picked up. I had a 3-inch thick record, and not one single crime in the whole thing, except drunk and fill in the blank. If you can do it drunk, I've done it drunk and been arrested for it a lot of times. And so he held that up, and he said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." And I said, "Yeah, I mean, my God, that's obvious. You've got a 3-inch thick record. That's fairly good evidence." And he said, "We have an AA group here," which didn't mean one thing to me. And I think you ought to go. I mean, this was just a friendly suggestion. We were far short of that mandating and paper signing stuff like we do today. But he just said, you ought to go. And that was the end of it. At least thought it was. And so I went back to my cell and continued to not think. And after about a week or so, I got a little slip of paper. It wasn't a letter or anything like it, but a little slip of paper laying on the bunk when I came back to the cell from somewhere. And I picked it up and said, "You could go to your first AA meeting Saturday, February 2nd of 57. And I didn't even know what AA was. I think somebody told me it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is not the sexiest name you could possibly call a program. Alcoholics Anonymous, secret drunks. Now, who wants to be that? I mean, that was not appealing. Like, you know, join the welcome wagon or something. But that thing came. And I was blessed. I was really blessed with what I think is the most important word in the language of recovery. It's called surrender. Surrender. I think that's far more important than knowledge and learned things and stuff like that. It's about giving up at the depth of my soul. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't understand it was a surrender process. But I just gave up, and I looked at my life that this is it, and this is what it's going to be till it ends. And so I was just a piece of a human sitting in a cage. And then when that thing came, so I think somebody, I don't even remember, but I think somebody's told me that AA stood for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not the jazziest name I've ever heard. It's not something you just want to say, "Oh, geez, I'd like to be one of those." And so I got that little note, and when I watched the routine, when they were going to let you out, it did have electricity back then. It wasn't that far back. But they didn't have it like you do now where you pull a switch and the door's open. They would announce, guy came in, made a big old noise, hit something and made a big noise. And when it died down a little bit, he said, "Hey!" Well, that meant, if you want to go to AA, when they throw the switch, you know, unlock the gate, what you do if you want to go is step up and pull your door open and then step out and do it. I did that. And if I'd have done that thinking logically through what I was doing, I wouldn't have done it. But I was so defeated that somehow or other I just responded to that. Didn't even know what it was, but I responded to it. Walked over to that first meeting that I referred to on 2nd of February, 1957. And had no earthly idea. I thought it was going to be some kind of a religious hootenanny. That's all I'd ever seen done with drunks. And you'd come to county jails and tell their stories and read books and sing. And every time they'd sing Amazing Grace, I'd join whatever movement they had. And it lasted about 30 minutes, and then it was over. And so I thought it would be some of that. Went in, first thing they did was pray. Same one we prayed here. It hadn't changed a lick. And while they were praying, I'm saying to myself, "Yep, just what I thought. Man, they'll be rocking here anytime." And I'm braced for it. And then went on in. The reason they had that little slip of paper thing, the day I walked in that prison, there were 6,338 people locked up behind one fence, about half the size of this conference. And everything was crowded, including AA. And so you had to have an opening before they could say, okay. So when I went over that day, they had a chair open. And went in, officer looked at my shirt, had my name written on it. And he said, yes, sir. And he said, go in and have a seat. So I walked in, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no earthly idea what it would be. I figured it's going to be something about drinking. But I didn't get deep into it, though, and I just walked in and got through that praying part untouched. And then we got in and we read a ton of stuff. God Almighty, they read everything but the newspaper. They read a ton. And I thought, boy, this is something. And then they got through with all that, and they introduced the speaker. And the guy who was speaking was from Detroit, and he's dressed up. You know, had on his obligatory blue preaching suit, and so he came walking in, and he didn't look bad if you didn't get close, but if you got close, he did not stand close examination. He'd been a professional boxer, and apparently wasn't very good at it. You know, that boy was chopped up something fierce. And so I'm looking at him and saying, what on earth is he doing here? All dressed up like he's going to some fancy. And he walked into a penitentiary. You know, he goes up, introduced him, told his story. I'd heard drunks tell every kind of story known to man. I never heard one like that. He shocked me. Because, I mean, obviously he was sober, but he's telling stuff that I wouldn't have told drunk as I'd ever been. And I thought, man, there's something wrong with this guy. He is loose. And now, I guarantee you, I didn't identify with anything about him. But I identify with our 11th tradition. And we're a program of attraction, not promotion. You know, that we attract people into what we do if we attract people. And so I went away more confused after the meeting than I was when I went in. And the next week I was back. And it wasn't because of any identification or, man, I found a solution. It was simply this guy was one of the most enthusiastic people I've ever met in my life. Thank God for enthusiastic people. And he was one of them. He was a guy that could walk in just like some people are. They walk in and the room lights up when they walk in. Don't have to do a thing. And he was that way. He told his story, and I didn't identify with the facts, but that spirit did something. And I just found myself walking back to that place. Now, if I hadn't been there, nobody would have looked for me. Nobody said, where's that nice guy that was sitting here last week? Nobody had paid attention. They'd have put some other dude in there. And so I went back in. Certainly didn't want to join up. I just was drawn to that thing. And for the next 3.5 years, I never missed a single meeting. You can hurry up and believe it wasn't because of any quick conversion or anything. I'm exactly what I said. You know, I was a terrible loser. I had such a mountain of guilt over me. I felt guilty of even looking at any place where decency was on the table. And so it was an uphill battle. But I am fortunate in that what I walked into was a three legacy group, not a little chat room. It was a three legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning it had unity, recovery, and service in good solid form. I didn't know any of that at the time, but I learned it pretty quickly. And so it was a good solid group. You know, what will happen in a group when a guy comes in, if they had waited for me to just take some initiative and make a move or try to get involved, I would have sat there forever. But people in a group have a sensitivity to doing what needs to be done. And so, yeah, guys started, you know, I'm probably one of the best chair setter uppers on this planet. Yeah, that was my first action. You know, because one day somebody said, hey, Tom, how about helping us get these chairs up? Well, I did. And it's an amazing thing. You talk to me all day long, didn't mean a thing. But it's just like anything. It's like being on a ball team. You don't feel much of a team if you don't get in the game. And so that's exactly what was happening. They said help. They didn't need help with the chairs. That's a good way of making somebody feel a sense of belonging. And so I started doing it. I take chairs away from people. Sometimes I still do it. But it was a beginning, eh? Where I started to feel apart. And now, it wasn't any rapid conversion whatsoever. You know, I didn't really understand anything about alcoholism, even though a lot of people told me I had it. I didn't. That group did a simple little thing that was fortunate for me. They had, and I became one of them before too long, but they take a few of the guys that were showing some leadership stuff, and And they would take the new guys that were coming in the group into a little separate room and just basically, not a newcomer meeting, that going through the book, anything like that, just basically an introduction to here's what a sponsor is, here's what a closed meeting, an open meeting. You know, just so you've got some sort of grasp on the language and you can understand what people are talking about. Just a simple little thing. There was a guy significant for me. A guy one day, a young fella, was talking about the steps. You know, a lot of times we have them hung up or stood up behind us in the meeting. Guy was going over that and he said, there are 200 words in those steps. And what I found is, if you'll take those steps as thoroughly and as honestly as you know how to do, when you get through, you'll be a different cat. And it doesn't even matter what your motives are. I said, come on, man. God, I didn't just fall out of the truck yesterday. I know better than that. But you know, the guy was absolutely right. He was 100% right. Back then, this whole business of taking people through the book and through the steps and all that, if it existed, I never saw it. I never went to a big book meeting until I was sober 15 years. We basically huddled up and talked steps and talked about sober, this kind of stuff. None of this kind of sort of digging in kind of thing. I'd never heard of it for a long time. And so, settled in. And I did what that young fellow said. I fumbled my way through those 12 steps. That ugly boxer became my first sponsor, but he lived 60 miles away, and we had a formidable barrier between us. But so we couldn't do a heck of a lot of him. But I had one guy in the group that we became friends. You know, we were just comfortable with each other. And he and I would walk around on the yard and just sort of talk about the steps. And that was extremely helpful to me. And I'll tell you this, if you don't think this is a powerful program, I don't think there's ever been a man, woman, or child in a penitentiary that hated it any worse than this guy. But I'm a guy who had an absolute transformation in one of the worst maximum custody penitentiaries on this planet. Had a tremendous, absolutely conversion experience. Doing exactly what that young fellow said. I did those steps the best I knew how to do. And when I got, you know, into the program, you know, doing it, I never really fully believed I was an alcoholic until I did the fourth step. And when I got through that, I thought, boy, if you're not an alcoholic, you sure in trouble. And so it was obvious that it was there, and it set the hook. When I got ready to do a fifth step, that other fellow that was locked up just like me was a good guy and a real sensible fellow. Some people say you got to go to the Sistine Chapel to do a fifth step. That's not necessarily so. I sat down on a real broken-down prison bench out on a yard with 6,300 people milling around with that guy. And he was the first human on this planet who ever heard who I was. First one. I opened up and did what we do in a fifth step. And as thorough as I knew, when I got through with that guy knew more about me than my mother knew. And I was a fellow who got up off that bench a different man. I was free. I was free. For the first time in my life. And I was still in a cage, but I was free. And I was a different man. Yeah, I was a different man altogether. Got extremely active in the group and truly had a transforming experience. I was one of the youngest guys in the joint. I became a leader there. And it wasn't because I intimidated anybody, for God's sakes, but it's because people respect you if you stand up for what you believe in. If you shoot straight, people respect you. Not about fear, it's about respect. And so I grew like that. And then one day, after I was, I don't know how we're doing, you may have to put the hook on me, but we got... I see this crowd shifting. I'm boogieing. But what happened? I had a 5 to 15 year sentence, so I was supposed to be there a long time. In Michigan, you had to be 4 years, one fourth of your maximum before you could even be considered for any kind of parole. I was aware of that. And one day, I didn't get a call. I got an announcement. Ivester, come over here. And I went over to the head shed. I was going to the head shed. Normally, the head shed meant bad news. And so I knew I hadn't done anything, but you never know. You might get ratted off for something that you didn't do. So I went over there with a little bit of anxiety, went to the appointed door, and the man came to the door, that I didn't know him, but he was the chairman of the parole commission for the state of Michigan. Well, everybody in the prison knew him. If you read the paper, you're going to read all of his history and all of his everything. So I walked in, and he said, we're walking back into the room where the whole parole commission back there. Walking in, he said, you probably are wondering why you're here. I said, well, yes, sir, I am. Why am I here? And he said, well, once every 10,000 cases, we pick one that we think is a remarkable example of restoration or rehabilitation. And we decided, that we wanted to talk with you. And I said, well, that's really an honor. And certainly is an honor. Out of 6,300 people, and they picked me as one of the outstanding examples of restoration or rehabilitation. And I was shocked by it all, but he took it right in stride, and he said, it's what we do, and so we're going to give you a hearing. He said, but I'll tell you before we get in there that we're not going to parole you at this point. You won't be released at this point. But what you can be assured of is if you continue like you are, you'll walk out the day you're eligible. I said, that's fine. That's fine with me. It wouldn't matter whether it's fine with me or not. That's what we're going to do. But it was fine with me. I understood that. And so I kept doing what I was doing. I was an active member of AA. Back then, we are a little more comfortable with institutions now than we used to be. Back then, it was both a hard rock things, and it was convicts, it wasn't inmates and stuff like that. And so people were a little flinchy about getting involved too much with a prison. And so I had some concerns about whether I would be welcomed to come out of a maximum custody institution in the state of Michigan. And they told me I was going to have to go back to North Carolina. And so I got hold of they're supposed to not be available, but I found them. I think I found it before it got lost, but I got hold of a world directory. And so I looked up my little old town, and sure enough, they had two groups listed. And one of them was kind of a small group. Will you raise your hand, Charity? Oh, I thought you was going to say something. If you do, I'll get out of the way now. I don't argue with Carol. She got all the money. She won $10,000 in a casino with me, and I didn't get 1 cent. She's forgotten it, but I haven't. But anyway, I got hold of those directories. So I naturally wrote to the one with the largest membership, and never got an answer. And I thought, oh, that's how this works. These guys who come in here and carry the message and all that, sure, they're interested in that. But people on the outside don't want somebody like me walking out of a maximum. That's all I'm asking. I'm going to be paroled to North Carolina. Is it okay if I come to your group? That's all I was saying. But when I didn't get an answer, that was an answer. I said, no, you won't be welcome here. And then I talked with my sponsor, the old boxer, and he said, no, Tom, don't get off on that. Man said, everything that calls itself an AA group is not an AA group. Sometimes people keep meeting, but there's nothing to it. It's just sort of a gathering of people, and it's not a meeting. And sometimes they close down. Sometimes they go out of business. And he said, don't be giving up on that stuff. You write to the other one. So I did, wrote to that other one. Got an answer back quicker than you could imagine from a guy who became my second sponsor after I got out. And he basically, it was music to my ears. I couldn't imagine what he would say, but he said, told me about the group, told me what they did, their activities and their eating meetings and stuff like that. It just made it sound like a homecoming. So he told me about that. He said, you'll be welcome here. We want you and we need you. And man, that's something to tell a guy in a maximum joint. We need you. Yeah, for what? And so I was released and went back to the state of North Carolina. Didn't really want to. I wanted to go. And I would even go to North Carolina. Went to work. Family got me a job at a mill. Went to work. I could make meetings as long as they didn't run past 9 o'clock. Many of them I couldn't stay for the Lord's Prayer. I'd have to just boogie. But I was never late for work. Worked there for a couple of years. Just 2 or 3 weeks after I was out, some guys came to me and said they didn't know me. They introduced themselves and said, we understand that you just got out of an institution up in Michigan. And I said, well, yeah, word gets around. And He said, well, we do some AA stuff over to a prison over here, just not too far from my home. And he said, we'd really like for you to go with us. And I said, you got to be kidding, man. I just got out. I'm not. You think I'm going back right in there? And he said, no, it'll be okay. It'll be fine. I said, yeah, right. And he said, no, it's all right. This is not a high custody place. And he said, you'll be okay there. And you really will add a lot to that. And so I agreed. I said, well, I'll go, but you better hope I get out. And if I don't get out, you better hope I never get out. And so I went in. And, you know, I'm just out of a maximum custody joint. 2 months after that, I was the outside sponsor of that group. I was responsible for the management of that and organization of it and that kind of thing. Unbelievable stuff. And I'll tell you some stuff that happens, and I know some of you are familiar with my way of describing it. That miraculous things happen here. They truly do. They're not every day, but miraculous, unbelievable things happen. And when I got out, you know, all I wanted to do was breathe free. I knew that AA was my lifeline, and I knew that I was going to be active in AA for the rest of my life. I knew that the day I walked out, and there was no question about it. So my game plan was in place, and so I'm just banging away. And my pro guy came to me one day, and I'm going to tell you some stuff that it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not, it's true. My pro guy came to me one day, and he was an observant guy. He said, Tom, you're really active in this AA thing. And it concerned me, but I thought he was going to tell me I need to slow down. I knew I wouldn't. I mean, even for him, I'm not going to slow down. But that's my life. He's talking about a restriction. I'm talking about my life. And so I said, yes, sir. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, well, yes, sir, I can't, you know, as if he didn't know. When I had been paroled from the state of Michigan, in letters, absolutely, it'd be 40-point print in our today's language, huge letters said, this man is to never operate a motor vehicle, period. I took that as a fact of life. My parole guy and I said that I can't, and he said, well, let me take a look at that. Now, that normally means when somebody in a government position says, let me take a look at that, it usually means goodbye. But it didn't that time. And so he called me just a little later, said, can you meet me at the Sears store? Now, this sounds like Andy Griffith stuff but I went up. That's where the license, it wasn't an agency. They had a little shelf on the wall that where you could sign the papers if you're filling out one of their papers. So I walked in. My pro guy standing there, the guy I didn't know, turned out to be the licensed man. So I walked up to him, and my man said, glad you came. And the other guy said, introduced himself. He says, Mr. Logan, your pro guy, tells me that you might like to have your driver's license. And I said, well, yes, sir, it would be helpful. Now, don't ask me to explain it. I can't. You know, God does a lot of stuff I don't understand. I see it when I see it. But he said that, and he handed me a driver's license. I mean, handed. It was already made out before I got there. And no test of any kind whatsoever. Horn blowing, nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. Didn't even pay for it. Yeah, they only cost $4 back then, but I never paid a thing. And I'm standing there dumbfounded, as you could imagine. Man, this stuff doesn't happen, man. This is not the movies. And sure enough, did. And that's not legal. There's no way that could possibly be legal. But I've been driving for well over 50 years, and so far it's holding up. That's amazing stuff, amazing stuff. That to me, you can hurry and believe, that's not political connections. I knew one politician in that state, that was the sheriff. And I knew him on official terms only. That was not a political thing. That was just, I don't know why that guy never told me why, but he saw something he believed in, and invested in it. And so I'm off and running. They really did need me in that town. They needed somebody, and I was somebody. because that thing was on the rocks, and I had the experience of holding the flag like everybody did in AA when the program was getting started. And my guy, the one that wrote me the letter, he got promoted in his industry and moved away. I was all at once the oldest member in town. And I thought, what did I do to deserve this? But I had an absolutely wonderful meeting. Some of the best meetings I ever went to were when I'd go by myself. You know, never had arguments about anything. Business meetings were a snap. You know, absolutely a dream. I was active as I could be. I was 12-stepping. I'll just tell you one little story about that real quick. It won't sound quick, but it's going to be quick as I can go. The 12-step calls are almost an extinct species in our fellowship now. You know, even though this is a group of people willing to spend a whole weekend out trying to grow in the program, I would bet that 75 to 80% of this group now have never experienced a 12-step call as receiver or giver. It's just almost an extinct thing in our fellowship. Back the days I'm talking about, it was anything but extinct. And so I started doing 12-step calls. Didn't know how, but you learn quick. I guarantee you wrestle enough drunks, you'll learn. So I was doing it. Got a call one night from a guy. This is a CPC story, if anybody wants. But no, I didn't know how to spell it then, but it's what it was. And I was doing this stuff. One night I got a call from a guy from the nice side of town, and I said, I don't know what this dude's up to. And so I went and got him. And usually, you know, folks from that side of town either wanted to get away so they could get a drink or something. And I made it a rule. I wouldn't let a guy get a drink till I was convinced I couldn't help him. And so I went with him at about 3 in the morning, and I just gave up and said, well, tell me where your favorite bootlegger is. He told me one I didn't know about. I thought I knew them all. He told me a new one. We went up there, and it was just a motley-looking place, of course. Cars all over the place. They're doing good business. And so we went in, and he bought a bottle of something. I shared tea. That thing never seen a store. That thing came good. God, I wouldn't have drunk that at all. I drank brake fluid one time, and it didn't look that bad. But anyway, here he goes. He gets the thing. And about that time, they never raided bootleg joints there. It was a real industry in our part of the world. But they made an exception that night. And all at once, police cars came in from everywhere. You'd have thought there was a riot somewhere. They came flying in there. And those cops came in. They started dragging drunks out, loading them up and stuff. I'm standing over there in the corner against the wall looking like a young student or something. And this one policeman kept looking at me. Finally, he couldn't stand it anymore. He came over and he said, Mister, what are you doing here? I said, you wouldn't believe it. And he said, try me. So I told him what I'm doing. He said, you're right. I don't believe that. Because back then, such a thing as a 12-step call was unknown in that territory and most everywhere else in the program. And he was pleased with that. He gave me the drunk, didn't load him up, gave me the drunk, gave me that rot gut stuff he was carrying around. That would have locked him up for giving it to me. But anyway, that started CPC in that town. But I think what he went back, put those folks in jail, and he wrote on the wall, if you got one that's too crazy to handle, call this guy. He knows what to do. And I guarantee you, I got introduced to 12-step calls. And just a wonderful experience, but it'll test you, buddy, I'll tell you that. And so that's what I'm doing. You know, I stayed there for 2 years and had a marvelous time. When I left town, that group that had died had 60 members, because all it takes is somebody that'll get the spark and give it some leadership. That's all it takes. It's some spirit. And so that's what happened. And I had something happen. Many of you are well aware, but I'll tell it anyway because of what it might do in the Hope Department. Sometimes the future looks a little bleak when you're doing this thing and you wonder if you'll ever get your act back together. But I'm a guy, all I wanted to do was be free. And I knew it was my way. I was offered some jobs. I'd done some sales stuff in the back. But I knew if I got in the fast lane too quick, it would be bad news. And so I didn't. I stayed working in that mill for those 2 years. And one day, I got a phone call from the headquarters of the prison system. A little surprising to me. I wasn't expecting anybody to call. usually when they call, they don't call, they send somebody. But anyway, the guy called to identify himself. I'd seen him one time. He's one of those guys making a tour of visiting prisons. And he went by, I think somebody told him to give me a pat on the back, you know, because I was working hard. And that's what he done. I'd seen him for 2 minutes. And so he identified himself, and he said, "Mr. Ivester, we are expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system. Wondered if you might consider accepting a position." And I automatically I said, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yeah, we know. We know. We've checked you out." And of course I had. And I told him, to myself, I said, "Man, there ain't no way." And it couldn't. I mean, at that time, there had never been an ex-con in history anywhere on this planet hired in a professional position in a prison system. I was well aware of that. Because, I mean, you know, anybody in the system is going to know stuff like that. I had no aspirations. You know, when I was sitting in there trying to get off speed in that cell, I guarantee you one of my ambitions was that I think I'll be out of here and run one of these suckers when I... No. They'll put you up if you start talking about it. But anyway, yeah, that's what he said. I told him, I said, "My God, I'd rather do that than anything I could have done. I would have done it for nothing and hustled for survival." But I said that, and to myself, I said, "It won't happen. There's no way." But it did. I think it was in 60 or something. I'd just been out for 2 years. I'm on the street. And I'll tell you something now. We're in a sophisticated part of the world here. I'm from Redneck, North Carolina, but I'll tell you this, I'm intensely proud of my state. My state was some of the most hard-line politicians I've ever seen step forward and did something that had never been done in history. Big gamble, big gamble. We had a senator who was famous for being Senator No. He had voted against his mama. I mean, that boy, he was, but we had one of the most enlightened governors you could ever have. And I didn't know what they were doing. I just know they told me that. And then, sure enough, I was employed. A weird thing, from the day I was employed till the day I retired, 39 years later, I never had one single person even ask me anything about my history. I mean, nobody. At the hiring, normally if a new employee's coming, you're going to get a history on them, background and all that. I guess they'd already got mine from somewhere else, but they didn't get it from me. And I couldn't believe it, but in 39 years, not a single person ever even mentioned it to me. And so I just went to work. You know, traditions that were read here tonight, to me, are some of the most powerful tools we have. I started a career. I hadn't even finished college. I finished after I got down there. But I tell you honestly, the education had absolutely nothing to do with my meteoric rise in the system. I just went to work. I gave it my best. I used AA traditions. You know, common welfare comes first is that thing. That's what it is with my employer. If I don't take care of my employer, they can't take care of me. And so I'm geared on traditions. I live by them, and they were what my primary tools in going out. I went to work. I gave it my best shot. And it's the God's truth. I never applied for one single job, ever. Ever. You know, transfer, promotion, nothing. Never applied. Every job I ever got, I was recruited for because I guess somebody said, "Look what that guy's doing. He might be able to do this." And so people tapped me on the shoulder and say, "Hey, how about trying this?" And I just started going up, getting ratcheted up in the system. I get hard to believe, you know. And one day I was traveling quite a lot, working with several facilities, and I was working in the headquarters building where the guy had called me from. And the director of the system gave me a call. He said, "Tom, when you're going out this evening, stop by my office. I have something I need you to do for me." I said, "Okay, fine." So I went down, and the big boss is down there. So went in, we howdied and for a minute or two. And I said, "Yeah, boss, what is it?" And he said, it still sounds ludicrous to me, but he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." And I tell you, when I got up off the floor, I said, you know, I was in the system. I mean, man, this is one thing. Legally, I couldn't even hold a gun. They're going to put me in charge of all of them. That's weird. And so when I got up off the floor, I said, come on, boss, I don't want to be the head screw. He said, I'm not looking for the head screw. I go, what do you want? And so he told me. He had a vision for what he wanted to see a prison become. It so happened. So just coincidentally, I had the same vision. And so he told me, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And he gave me a wonderful kind of an introduction. He drove me to the prison I was going to take over as warden and just left me there. I mean, there's no introduction. He just drove in. And so I'm going into the office, and he starts to drive. I said, hey, boss, wait a minute. Wait a minute, man. Don't leave me down here with these cannibals. And so anyway, I did, and I had a magnificent career. I went up as high as I wanted to go, and then some, really. I put in a 39-year career. Thank you very much. Couldn't have been a better career than that. And so I'll just wrap it up this way. The day I retired, I'm a pretty active guy. And the day I retired, I had some guys from AA call me and say, can we meet with you? We hear you're retiring. And word gets around at AA for an anonymous fellowship. I guarantee you, we got a great vibe. And so they said, we understand you're going to be retiring, and we'd like to meet with you. I said, okay, fine, we'll meet. And they did. And so they told me, said, we've got some real problems in the prison system, and we feel like maybe you could do it. We need some leadership, and we feel like you're the guy that can give it. And I'm thinking, geez, I've been 39 years. Let me just go sit in the mud or something. Let me take a break. And I said, when did you have in mind doing this? They said, the day you retire. My wife was so thrilled when I told her that. Said, well, we rotate. Yeah, she said, I know, I've seen it. Rotates very slowly. And so I did, and I went to work. I'm an extremely active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't used to be. I am. And I'm tremendously active at every level. I won't go into it, but I think we have lots of things that we need to pay attention to in AA. We're not the happy, joyous, and free bunch. We've got some real problems in the fellowship. If you don't know what they are, you can give me a call or an email. One of these heads will tell you how to get in touch with me over here. So there's a lot of work to do. And this is part of it. This is a spirit builder here, and I think everybody here will leave going back and saying, man, I want to do something more than what I'm doing. And I hope to God you will, because we got a lot of stuff we need to do at AA. I just want to thank you for letting me go this late in the evening, because I know you're kind of a little weary by now. So I thank you for the attention. And look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks. Good job.